Okay, we'll bring the meeting to order. The Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee start out with a roll call.
Representative Cornish.
Here.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine. Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howell. Representative Lomer. Representative Lucero.
Here.
Representative Neuberger. Representative O'Neill.
Here.
Representative Pinto.
Here.
Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwas.
Present.
Okay, I entertain a motion to approve the minutes for February 28th.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frankie was here last time.
Yep.
A motion to approve the minutes for February 28th. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Okay, first bill up today, House File 643. The Chair will move House File 643 to be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Peterson, identify yourself by name and title and begin. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Roz Peterson, and I'm here to present House File 643, which is the Board of Medical Practice Title Protection and the Disciplinary Action. It's pretty technical in nature, but under the purview of this committee, I believe it's having to do around the violations amounting to a gross misdemeanor, which is the same as it currently is. But I also have Ruth Martinez here as well to also speak to the bill and add some
turn the volume up a little bit.
Clarifying pieces too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, ma'am, go ahead with your name and title and begin. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Ruth Martinez. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Medical Practice. And I'll just tell you a little bit about this bill. This does do some housekeeping changes specific to strengthening title protection for terms used and understood to be used exclusively by physicians, and to also do some modifications and updates to the grounds for disciplinary action to offer clarity and more specific descriptive language regarding the behavior that underlies actions against licensees. And I just want to make a point of the intent. It is the intent of the Board of Medical Practice in pursuing this legislation to assure its authority to protect the specific titles defined in Chapter 147 for use by individuals licensed or otherwise authorized to practice medicine under this chapter. It is not the intent of the Board of Medical Practice to preclude other health professionals from using title designations as defined in their respective practice acts or other designations that are not specifically protected by Chapter 147, including but not limited to podiatric physician, doctor of chiropractic, and doctor of dental surgery as some examples. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Members, any questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author and the testifier. Has there been a big increase in people holding themselves out as medical doctors, or is there a reason why we're seeing this today versus, say, 5 years ago? Just curious if there's been a change sort of out there in the healthcare industry with other individuals who may not be licensed or qualified using the title.
Director?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, thanks for the question. This was driven specifically by a case that the board had in recent years involving a healthcare professional who advertised using the titles the doctor and physician without any qualifier about his actual credentials. And because of where the title protection was housed in our statute, this particular individual, when we wanted to proceed forward, cited an exemption under Chapter 214, claiming that as another healthcare professional, he could indeed use that title. And our legal counsel at the Attorney General's office did not feel that we could necessarily successfully win in litigation. And so we had the advice of our legal counsel to move title protection to an independent section. So it's exactly the same titles that are protected, but they are no longer subject to the exemptions that are otherwise applied sometimes under the Section 081.
Okay. Any other questions, members? If none, any public testimony? Seeing none, Representative Peterson, any closing comments for your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the Chair will move House File 643 to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Peterson. Now we have House File 1579, Representative Brassel. You can move your own bill to be held over, Representative Brassel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the representatives.
You do.
And I move that the bill be held over for possible inclusion.
Okay, go ahead and begin, sir.
My name is Representative Mac Russell, and I'm here to present Bill 1579, the Sheriff's Transportation Conveyance. The bill reforms the billing process for reimbursement to counties for costs they incur transporting inmates to and from state correctional facilities. Under current law, counties submit bills for each specific trip. The bill allows payments to be made up to two times each fiscal year based on a fee schedule agreed to by the Department of Corrections and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. The total amount of the payments may not exceed $500,000 annually. Mr. Chair, I have Lisa Wojcik, Assistant Commissioner of Minnesota DOC, and she will go ahead and explain.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Lisa Wojcik. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections, along with our partners, the Sheriff's Association, conducted a continuous improvement process to look at how we pay each county for transporting offenders. In this process, we found out that there are 39 tasks with each and every bill we receive. It is handed off 11 times, and most importantly, it takes about 826 hours to process all of these payments between the DOC and the counties. We are working on an agreement with the Sheriff's Association to reduce this to make payments to the counties twice per fiscal year, and we estimate that this will reduce the staff time down to 15 hours from the 826. We do have support from the Sheriff's Association, and I'm open for any questions.
Okay. Commissioner, why the limit of the $500,000? Is that mere other law, or is it what's the reason for that?
Mr. Chair, we wanted to put a cap on that dollar amount because initially the agency was budgeted $130,000 for this expense, and it has continued to increase over the years. And statutorily, I believe it says we may reimburse, and so we want to be able to reimburse, but we do not have unlimited funds to continue the dollar amount that's been increasing over the past 5 years.
Okay, and this has been agreed to by the Sheriff's Association. All you have to do is nod your head there. Huh? I just want to make sure that we didn't need the testimony as long as we're in agreement. Okay, any questions? Representative Hillsburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this bill is fine, and I think even putting a cap in place is fine as long as the Department of Corrections is working to help minimize the number of transports as well that need to be done through ITV and other technologies that might be used. And so I'm hoping that the Department of Corrections will take steps to help with that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, of course we are.
Thank you.
Questions from members? Any public testimony? Seeing none, Representative Brassel, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not really, but thank you for hearing us today. And it's Bemidji Day, and it's fun to give them a little plug. I get to wear the plaid vest for Paul Bunyan, and it's up in 500 North if anybody wants to stop by.
Okay, thank you, Representative Brassel. With that, the bill will be held over for possible inclusion, 1579. Now, we have House File 813, Representative Johnson. You may move your bill also for possible inclusion.
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to move this bill for possible inclusion.
Okay, Representative Johnson, you go ahead however you wish to proceed.
Members, this bill deals with an issue that one of the probation departments is dealing with, the Department of Corrections. It allows for the counties that generally just do misdemeanor and juveniles and gross misdemeanors, allows them, if needed, to do adult felony probation services. Currently, or right now, this language in this bill is very permissive, and it was intentionally done that way because most of these counties do not want to do the felony services. And this bill was also written that there is no funding if the county decides to do them. But the, right now, currently by state statute, it is a violation of state statute for a county probation officer under this program to provide services. Currently, they're between felony bail evaluations, felony pretrial supervision, and felony supervision of sentence. There's about 4,500 county probation officers that are in violation of state statute because they're doing this. This change in the statute is just to allow them to do this because they're sometimes being ordered by the courts to do it, and just makes it so that they're in line with the current statutes. Today I have Steve King from Maurer County and also Mike McMillan from Wright County with me to also go over this.
Okay, sir, if you could identify your name and title and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve King, Director of Maurer County Corrections. I'd like to remind the members that I was here about 3 weeks ago to talk about the delivery service in the delivery that we deliver, the correction system that we delivered in county probation model. Representative Cornish, Chair Cornish, you were gone sick that day, so there will be some refresher for most. I just want to touch on some of what I touched on there. It comes back around again for the reason why we're here today. When I was here before you 3 weeks ago, I talked about partnership and choice. And our partnership in the three delivery systems is alive and well. There is nothing broken. There is nothing damaged. All three get along famously. Probation services get delivered nicely. This is an opportunity to legitimize what we are already doing in county probation model. In all of the roughly 26 counties that deliver county probation system model, we are doing the pretrial services for those that have been arrested on a felony arrest. We're doing those at pretty high volumes. I believe it's about 20, looks like, roughly 2,000 people a day are on pretrial services being seen daily, weekly at our county probation office, and these folks are arrested with a felony offense. So there's reasons I want to keep this brief and let my mentor and friend Mike McMillan help out here too. But here's reasons why we should include this language in the statute. It allows us to be responsive to judges. We are associated with the courts because we're very well physically tied to them just down the hall from the courtrooms. The court relies upon us to produce services at the drop of a hat. They ask us to supervise these pretrial offenders in a very robust way, and we answer that call. It also legitimizes what we're already doing. I mentioned throughout the CPO model counties, the pretrial services falls on that county service. It, by legitimizing that through the words allowing us to supervise felons and provide services, that just... It does. It just legitimizes what we do. We take the load off the DOC. If the Department of Corrections today, and we've been doing pretrial services like we're doing it now for 12-plus years in Maurer County, 125 people are on pretrial services today in Maurer County. If the DOC were decided to, you know what, we'll take on that burden. We'll take on that load. We'll start providing pretrial services. It's our highest caseload among those that are sentenced and pretrial those that aren't sentenced. If the DOC were to provide that service, I don't think they have the infrastructure for it. They'd have to hire at least 27 people. And so we're willing to offer this at no charge. And this is a freebie, folks. There's no money tied to this change. We're happy. We have the infrastructure going. The community likes it. The judges like it. The attorneys like the services we provide in those pretrial services. So we do take a good-sized load off the DOC and the county probation. Also, what's happening, the probation, when a felon goes in front of the judge for a probation violation and denies the violation, it's set for a hearing, maybe a month or maybe more away. In that interim, that felon is not being supervised by the Department of Corrections. So the judges have gotten wise. They think this is an important time for someone to be supervised while they're in violation status. They're ordering, and I have plenty of orders and have since about 2012, been receiving orders from our judges, and the counties that work in this model also have these same orders, where the judge is asking that the county probation office supervised, whether it's 1 day, 3 days, or 5 days a week, to check in, or 7 days a week, check in with that county probation office during this interim period when they're denied their violation and have not yet been resentenced. That's what's happening. And so I think, again, this bill would legitimize that. So here's reasons. Now you have reasons why we should. Here's reasons why you potentially might not want to add this language. Might as well get it out there, because you're going to hear it from maybe the Community Corrections Act folks or the Department of Corrections folks. What we're hearing is, what if? What if we get a rogue judge that decides to send all the felonies to our county probation office? I can answer that clearly and say there is no chance I would be in favor of that. And if that's the case, if the rogue judge says, you know what, let's get every felon, and then basically booting the Department of Corrections out, no chance. Our partnership is too strong. We work together too nicely, and we don't have the personnel to handle that load. If that's the case, we would use the other word I've used before, is choice. If that's the case, I would advocate for the choice to be made to go Community Corrections Act. This is potentially just going to impact a few. I would say in Austin, Minnesota, two offenders a year would probably come to me on a sentenced felony. I couldn't imagine any more. What we're getting, the county attorney would come to me, our county attorney, Kristen Nelson, is in favor of this bill, this language, because a couple times a year she says, you know what, Steve, I'd sure like to, this guy here has a felony, and we could get him for a felony. But I'm just worried that he may be not getting the services that you could provide him in line with your analysis, programming, chemical dependency treatment. He may just be a minimum or a group supervision person at the Department of Corrections. I know that your office would provide a little bit more of an enhanced supervision for this individual. And it may be political, as these elected officials and county attorneys, one of them. It may be just that one or two offenders that has this status around town that they want to appear, you know what, we're going to do something different with this guy. We're going to be sure that we give those your analysis, and we're going to be sure that we have some control over his supervision. So those things are also happening. Again, that's where I'd get my one or two a year in Austin, Minnesota. Another reason why you might not want to do this is you're going to hear this is creating a fourth delivery system. In my mind, it's absolutely not creating a fourth delivery system. In fact, it's enhancing what we have. It's enhancing the partnership between the Department of Corrections and county probation model. Wouldn't it be nice if you have this language and the Department of Corrections, in the ebb and flow of supervision, happens to have a very high caseload in some area of the state, and they don't have the resources, they don't want to come ask for more bodies. Wouldn't it be nice if the Department of Corrections could ask the county probation officer or director there and say, could you take 10? Could you take 10 felons for a time, a year? Could you take them? Wouldn't it be nice to have that partnership and have that available? That's what this language, I believe, would do. And I'd certainly like to call Mike McMillan to have
his question. One of the considered felons, you talked about providing pre-service or service pre-trial. So are they considered felons yet?
You know, my take is they're not considered a felon until they get sentenced as a felon. So, no. The activity that the crime they've done is a felony-level offense. We also, in that pretrial service arena, do the bail studies. All the bail studies are done on all those offenders that come through the county office, not the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Next up, your name and title, and begin.
Mr. Chair, Mike McMillan, Director of Wright County Court Services, Probation Department, and representatives. Thanks. Kind of back to that question about felons, the judges today are also expecting, and they're putting a number of conditions on those individuals while they're on pretrial. So we're not only just drug testing them, we're also doing other types of conditions, GPS monitoring, you know, public safety issues that the courts are concerned about with some of the offenders that we're dealing with, even though, yes, they have not been convicted. But, you know, from a public safety standpoint, there's clearly a lot of work that's being done that really wasn't done 10 to 15 years ago, as Director King has said. A couple of examples I want to talk about, and Steve mentioned a few of those, but one of those is, you know, what are we doing with those felony offenders now on probation? And there isn't a lot of them. I think Steve did a really good job of kind of acknowledging that. We're the biggest CPO county today, and I think we supervise 62 felony offenders after sentence, and a number of those are DWI offenders. When the statute changed, we came into an agreement with DOC with our county attorney and with our court and our county board that we would supervise those DWI offenders. We've created a specialty caseload, intensive supervision for those, and they fit very well into our system, and it's been a very positive relationship with everybody involved in our criminal justice system. So our numbers aren't astronomical. In drug court, we've actually formed a drug court. Representative O'Neill was part of that advisory group in Wright County. And our drug court, though, because the court wanted our department to run drug court, was structured a little differently than some, and ours is done on a pretrial basis with felony offenders. Operated out of my department, the drug court coordinator as well as the agent sit in my department. So to Director King's point, we're already doing those types of services with those felony offenders, and we have no wish or want or need at this point to say that we take all felons, but our court in certain situations want that to happen. And then there's some funky things going on around the state. I just found out from a couple of my colleagues in back. There's services being provided for felony offenders in cooperation with DOC, as Mr. King talked about, and Itasca County as an example. They are doing programming for domestic abuse offenders for a period of time with their intensive agent, and then they go back to their felony agent after that 1 year period of time as part of that program. Same thing's also happening in a couple of southern counties. John Shiro talked about some of the stuff that's going on in Brown County, very similar, where they're providing the service that can't be provided now under DOC, but we're doing that for them. And it's a cooperative effort. It's not them and us. It's working together to provide that service for the felons. So this piece, using the word may, cleans up the statute to allow some of that to happen, as Mr. King said, legitimize it. I was here to testify last year. I don't think our position is any different. I think we're providing a great service. I think we have great cooperation between the three delivery systems, and this just cleans up a piece that's been going on for years and years in our counties.
Members, questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have Richard K. from MAPE. Go ahead and give us your name and title and begin, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Richard Kajewski, actually. I'm the Public Affairs and Communications Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. In my capacity, I do represent all of the DOC agents. Mr. Chair and members, House File 813 really is a solution to an existing problem for some of our members. As you know, all three delivery systems are heavily focused on evidence-based practices that target reductions in recidivism. Evidence-based practices are primarily focused upon additional interaction between agents and staff. With current caseloads, that type of interaction just doesn't happen to the fullest extent possible. Employees have too much work to complete that is critical to public safety, while also making recidivism a key priority. Our employees are extremely dedicated. They devote evenings and weekends to each of us. It is extremely difficult for any of them to keep up with current duties and initiatives when they should be working more intensely on high-risk offenders and reducing recidivism rates. This bill further protects current employees and is not an attempt to gain county membership. I would like to thank MACPO for actually coming to us before the session started to engage in a conversation and partnering with us. This is a collaborative effort between county management and employees with the state of Minnesota. It's a good bill. It's how bills should be done here at the Minnesota Legislature. I would urge your support and MAPE to support this bill. Thank you.
Any questions, members? Okay, thank you, sir. Appreciate it. Ron Solheid, Commissioner, Department of Corrections. Welcome. However you would like to begin with your name and title.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections. Committee members, I have the highest regard for the testifiers that just presented and many of those in the audience. We've had our eyeballs on this particular bill for a while, starting last year, and we also have positive comments about the collaboration between the three delivery systems. Have some concerns about some of the language, and I think it's important for committee members to hear those concerns. If you refer to line 1.14, the new language, and may provide additional adult felon probation services. The may has already been referenced, and that seems to be just fine. We are concerned about the definition of additional adult felon services. As you know, those services that are provided to felons can start with the diversion program, pretrial supervision and bail assessment that you heard about, drug court, sex offender supervision, sex offender therapy, housing assistance, and at the very end of failure, there can be some felon services regarding fugitive apprehension, all of which are encompassed the total package of felony services. We would be very comfortable with this statute if, in fact, it was more defined in terms of what probation services mean. If, in fact, the language is crafted to say pretrial services, I think we would be comfortable with that because it's very focused and it defines what role those offices would have. Second, we are concerned about the decision-making about which service provider to use. So in a county that has this hybrid system, I will call it, with two options to the court, either use Department of Corrections or either use the county officers who do X number of services. That really delegates the judicial branch to determine which county service to use and which state service to use. It's not well crafted in this particular statute of what criteria would be used to make that decision or what the court would look at unless those services are defined. It is conceivable that a judge or two judges in a particular county could agree that we prefer to use county services and we will not use state services for felony supervision anymore. This modification would allow that. Whether it would happen or not, I have no clue. But certainly there are counties that like to have county services nearby, and the state services sometimes are not spoken about highly. To a degree, this takes away some of the authority of county commissioners, and I thought we would hear some testimony today by commissioners or commissioner associations about support or no support. But typically, when a county is considering a service delivery strategy, the county commissioners or county administrator will contact us and say, can you give us an analysis of how this would impact a county budget, how it would impact county services? And we provide that. We do it in a neutral fashion. These are the facts. This is the money associated with these services. You county commissioners make a decision. And I just don't know what the role of the counties are in this particular modification. We have a limited pool of money associated with county probation officers and their functions, and Deputy Commissioner Solheid can talk about the funding of those services, which may be impacted by this as well.
Welcome, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Ron Solheid, Deputy Commissioner at Department of Corrections. I'll try not to get too much into the weeds, but essentially there is a pool of funding that is appropriated by the legislature every year every biennium for reimbursement to the county probation offices. There are 54 counties. That would include 28 counties that the DOC provides misdemeanor and juvenile supervision in, and the 26 counties that there are county probation offices. The funding is essentially reimbursement, and it's based upon the number of corrections agents that are in that funding pool. Right now there are about 210 corrections agents that are funded through that process. Counties now are receiving about a 30% reimbursement rate based on the salary and fringe of those officers. And that pool is only increased when the appropriation is increased, but subsequently it can be, the percentages that counties receive can be decreased when additional staff are added to that pool. So that is one thing to keep in mind is if additional staff are added into that pool, it does decrease the reimbursement rate that all of the counties within that funding stream receive.
Mr. Chair, if in fact previous testimony indicates that it is cost neutral, it may very well be in the short term. The future is unknown, and once these things are promulgated into statute, it is conceivable that certain courts might require additional staff to do felony services at the county level. And it is more of a concern for the counties than it is for us, but clearly we have state staff working in those counties, and we'd like to have some consistency in predicting the future. Again, if I was to leave my testimony with one thought, the thought would be to be far more definitive in the definition of what additional felony services are. Thank you.
Commissioner, do you think this bill could be fixed up so that the Department of Corrections would be able to work something out with language so that it would work, or is it?
Mr. Chair, I said my words that I just said, we have talked about with the county folks that if this was crafted to say pretrial services, we would be comfortable with it. There is also a discussion potential for gross misdemeanor DWIs, which we, the state supervises in some jurisdictions. So if they're looking for work at no cost, we can certainly accommodate that.
Okay, Commissioner, thank you very much. A question, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, one of the things that this committee likes a lot are specialty courts, and we want people to be successful through that process. Would you envision that whatever language you might be willing to negotiate would include those other kinds of items? Because, for example, I am confident that the Department of Corrections might not be available for every specialty court that we might like to have on this committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we have very healthy relationships already in jurisdictions that have specialty courts. And, in fact, those counties that have received grants, the grant requirements often talk about the collaboration with all correctional entities within a jurisdiction. So absolutely, yes, we fully participate, and we expect that we would do that in the future, and that we could probably craft some language related to that.
Thank you. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is, I can't resist noting just a very tiny thing on line 1.10. It looks like an extra space got dropped in by the revisor's office by accident. So if you're as it's being corrected, might want to get rid of that.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, that would be the extent of our comments. Thank you.
Okay, questions? Representative Considine.
Representative Johnson, is something you think you can work out?
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, that's exactly what I want to do. One of the concerns I had was because of the way the statute is written, even though if there's collaboration with the DOC and the county areas, it's still in violation of state statute right now for them to do that, especially in the specialty courts.
Okay. Other questions, members? If not, thank you, Commissioner and Commissioner. And we have Midge Christensen, Director of Community Corrections.
Good morning, Chair Cornish and members of the committee. My name is Midge Christensen. I am the legislative chair for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties, or MACAC. I'm also the director of community corrections for Chippewa, Lac La Parle, Swift, and Yellow Medicine Counties. I am here today on behalf of MACAC and the counties to voice concerns that we also have as the counties that supervise the bulk of felons along with the Department of Corrections in Minnesota. Along with the commissioner, we do not have concerns about this bill. If it were limited to pretrial supervision, pretrial bail evaluations, that type of thing, we have no concern about that and feel that that would be an excellent solution, and we would support that. We do have concerns about pre-sentence investigation and post-sentence supervision under this bill. As you know, we already have a fragmented delivery system in Minnesota. With respect to my colleagues from court services that testified about this not being a fourth delivery system, in some respects, this would just muddy the water as far as the delivery of services. Adding complexity to this system is not good for stakeholders, for folks who have to navigate the system, for the legislature when it would come down the road to potential funding concerns. So that is a concern that we have going forward. If counties do wish to supervise felons, there is a mechanism in place. It's the Community Corrections Act. If you are too small to go into the act, we do have opportunities to join together. Another remedy to that would be to simply lower the minimum population. That would not change the entire delivery system structure. It would just enable more counties to participate in the act and deliver those post-sentencing felony supervision. One of our biggest concerns, however, is with regard to the issue that the commissioner brought up about counties and county control of who delivers their services. As an affiliate of AMC, MACAC finds itself in the role of being a responsible steward regarding good correctional practice in Minnesota for the counties. This proposal was brought to AMC by the Court Services Association, and they requested endorsement through the legislative committee process at AMC. AMC failed to support this proposal through their committee process. County commissioners specifically noted a couple of concerns, one that the commissioner brought up, which was there is no funding tied to this for post-sentencing supervision by the counties. Counties in CCA are asked to deliver that service, and they make a conscious choice through a very well-thought-out process where they take on supervision and those deliveries of services. And this bill is very muddy regarding that. And we would echo the commissioner's concerns about counties being put in a position where they are providing post-felony services that the judge wants, but the county commissioners who are funding that do not have a say in this process. The bill lacks clarity in if or how the county board decides what is best for them to provide as far as services. I think that is all the concerns we have. We feel this bill is problematic in many aspects. There are ways that it could be tightened up that we would support, and we would be happy to work with court services and the Department of Corrections and anything we can add to that. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions for the testifier? No? Thank you. Any public testimony? Anybody else? Okay, members, if there aren't any questions, I'll have Representative Johnson closing comments.
Mr. Chair, members, our probation system that we have, the three-tier system, works and works well. Unfortunately, sometimes the one system is put in a position where they're required to do something that by laws they cannot do. And this is trying to fix that. There potentially was no funding in this system, in this bill, because if a county wants to go to felony probation, there's a process for them to do that. This is just to allow, and as I believe it was one of my testifiers stated, it was a special person that the judge believed that the services that the state would give would not be what might not be the best for that individual to make him succeed and be a better person. That does not happen very often. But they are providing services now in violation of statute, and we just need to clean it up. And if a county does want to continue it without going into the other process, there is no funding intentionally to make sure that the state part of it is also done in the proper way.
Okay. With that, your bill will be held over for possible inclusion to the omnibus bill, House File 813.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will work with the other entities to clean it up.
Thank you much. House File 251, Representative Lunan. Mr. Chair, we'll move the bill in front of it for her layover for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, House File 251. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I want to thank you and the committee for hearing this bill. What this bill does is repeals what currently is in statute as a gag order that, in Minnesota, it is illegal to drive a vehicle and not be wearing your seatbelt. And that's on the criminal side. However, on the civil side, if you run into me and I get injured and I sue for my injury, the jury is not allowed to know that I decided to not be wearing my seatbelt. And you think, well, why would that be? It doesn't make any sense. Well, back when the seatbelts came around, back in the 60s, when this was enacted, Minnesota had a different way of leveraging liability or negligence. There's two ways states do it. There's contributory negligence and there's comparative negligence. In contributory negligence, what happens is either you are totally innocent or you are at fault. Those are the two options. It's all or nothing. If there is anything you did at all to be a factor in what your loss was, in this case your injury was, then you cannot collect at all, even if the other party was more at fault. However, Minnesota has changed over years ago to what is called comparative negligence. And in comparative negligence, what happens is every time there's an incident, an accident, there's a pie of negligence that equals 100%. And all parties involved get a piece of that pie till it equals 100. So we compare how much you were at fault to how much I was at fault in the accident. So going back to the analogy of you run into me and you injure me. You may have run a stop sign, which makes you primarily at fault for the cause of the accident, but the cause of my injury, which is what the lawsuit is about, I now get a piece of pie because the fact that I decided to not wear my seatbelt, I have responsibility for that negligent act, which is failing to act as a reasonable person would act. On police reports at the scene of an accident, one of the data pieces that is gathered is, was everybody or each person, were they or were they not wearing their seatbelt? It's a factor. The seatbelts are not necessarily a factor in all accidents. In court cases, we have what's called the rule of evidence. In the rule of evidence, in a civil proceeding, the judge would decide what gets to be admissible to the jury and what doesn't. And they would decide, was that seatbelt usage or failure to usage be a factor in this case? And then the jury would decide what percentage of negligence or what bearing that would have on the case. The when we take a look at auto claims or insurance claims, there are two factors that come into play. There's the frequency or likelihood of a claim occurring, and then there's the severity or the dollar amount of the claim. Now, in a car accident, there's the actual collision, but the injury is separate from that. Is the actual injury, you take again, take a look at the frequency or the likelihood of it occurring, and if you don't wear your seatbelt, you're obviously more likely to get injured. If you don't wear your seatbelt, the severity of the injury is also typically going to be increased as well. Now, you're going to hear testifiers today from the defense lawyer side, and you're going to hear testifiers from the trial lawyer side. I want to tell you why they're both here. In comparative negligence, if my failure to wear my seatbelt is disclosed to the jury and it is determined in a court of law, because it has to be proved, that that was some kind of factor in my injury, my piece of pie gets bigger. The person that I'm suing, because my piece of pie, my amount of negligence gets bigger, what I can sue them for, collect from them, now becomes less, and which is a smaller figure that a trial lawyer can contingent on. The defense attorneys, I expect, will support this bill because what we'll end up having to get paid out in defending the primary offender, the tortfeasor in this case it's called, would be reduced as well. So that's why those two players are going to be here. The putting your seatbelt on is the responsibility of the decision the actual seatbelt wearer makes. No other one's choice, with the exception of a youth in a car seat. The current statute, the current gag order, already does not apply to whether a youth seat was installed correctly, was manufactured correctly. That's already out. This bill doesn't change that at all. And so what I'm asking, members, is that we remove the gag order, and so the evidence, which just like if I'm driving down the road, the jury gets to know if I was late for work, was that a factor? When I was driving down the road, did I have a full cup of coffee that I was trying to manage? That's a factor. I want them to be able to know also, was I or was I not wearing my seatbelt? Because that's a factor. The testifier I have today with me, Mr. Chairman, Troy Pultz from the Defense Attorneys Association.
Thank you.
This testifier in support or?
We'll find out.
But
no, he's supporting.
Oh,
I'm hoping.
I hate to ruin the suspense, yes. I am supporting.
What did, if you begin with your name and title, and begin, sir.
I will. Mr. Chair, representatives, my name is Troy Pultz, and I am the president of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. We are a 700-plus member organization. We are committed to helping our civil practitioner members in the defense, the litigation, and the trial of their case. Sort of our mission statement is to level the playing field. And that's really what this is about and why we're in support of this bill. We believe that all relevant information should be admitted and that the jury should consider it. And this is relevant evidence for the reason that the representative, or for the reasons the representative just mentioned. This is one of the only pieces of conduct where you are mandated to do something. In other words, wear a seatbelt. Where your violation of that statute, of that mandate, is not admissible in trial. In other words, this is the only instance I can think of where you violate a law as a driver that affects maybe how extreme you were hurt, or whether you were hurt at all, whether you were ejected, and that can't be considered by a jury. It's interesting, when you talk to the person on the street, this is by no means scientific, but when you talk to the person on the street or if you talk to just family members, when I was coming down here, I told my wife what I was doing today. She said, well, isn't that evidence admissible? I mean, to everybody, it just seems relevant. It matters. It matters for causation, and it matters for damages. In terms of causation, it certainly doesn't cause the accident. Whether or not you're wearing or not wearing a seatbelt doesn't cause an accident. But does it cause or contribute to the injuries? But in terms of damages, does it make the injuries worse? Well, we know that in over 50% of the fatality car accidents in Minnesota, it is because there was non-use of seatbelt. But because of the laws that exist now, the jury can't hear that. So really what we're advocating is that the jury hear all relevant evidence. I would say that it's analogous to an OSHA case where a worker is climbing a tower and they're clipped on with their safety belt, which they're mandated to do. And someone comes by with a ladder and hits that person and they fall and they die. And a lawsuit starts between the person that fell and the person with the ladder. Well, obviously the fact that the gentleman that wasn't wearing the safety belt, that evidence is going to come in that he wasn't wearing the safety belt. That's a rule. You're supposed to do that. That's no different than this case, where you are mandated to wear a seatbelt. So we are in support of the bill, and I would entertain any questions.
Mr. Chair.
We have Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're also mandated to have insurance, so would you be in favor of having it be permitted, admissible evidence, that you do or do not have insurance as at the time of the crash?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillman?
Hillstrom.
Hillstrom, sorry.
It's okay.
They are apples and oranges, so I would say no. And that's why I started with the foundational building block of every trial. The first things we argue about as trial lawyers is what evidence is admissible. So the judge has to look at what's called Rule 403, and that is it relevant? So the question is, in the standard cases that I try around Minnesota, there's two questions. What is the liability and what are the damages? In other words, who committed a wrong act and what are the damages? And whether or not a person has liability insurance certainly doesn't play into who's at fault for an accident.
Neither does if I'm wearing a seatbelt or not.
Well, Representative, I would say certainly it does. Certainly it goes to causation of your injuries. I mean, if a person is ejected from a car and they weren't wearing their seatbelt, and we know that in all likelihood, or at least if we provided scientific evidence in trial, that wearing a seatbelt would have kept you inside that secure compartment, then you did contribute to your severe injuries. Whereas liability insurance, I'm not sure how that satisfies a relevance test, how that's probative.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The testimony was that the jury should get to hear all of the facts. That's been the testimony about this bill.
Did you?
I'm going to finish the sentence. Yes. So the question is, why is one relevant fact whether or not I'm wearing a seatbelt? Whether or not I'm wearing a seatbelt, I'm sitting in my car, I'm stopped, and a drunk driver comes and hits me. I've done nothing, but maybe I'm not wearing my seatbelt at that second. Whether or not I have a seatbelt on, if I'm stopped at a light, has no relevancy on whether or not what caused that crash to happen. Zero. So it's my understanding this bill goes to that, not just the injury.
Either one of you want to answer?
Mr. Chairman, at the rule of evidence, whether or not they had insurance, what my tax return says, a judge would decide that that is inadmissible because that had nothing to do with the cause of the crash, had nothing to do with the level of any injury. That's why that wouldn't be admissible, and that's why it's not admissible. Where they would determine, and there are times when they would not determine that seatbelt usage would be admissible because it may not have a factor at all in how injured I am or whether I'm injured or not. What this bill does is allows the jury, the judge, in a per-base situation to make the decision of is this a factor or not. This is just basic common sense on that. That's why in any case of rule of evidence, it's not uncommon that there are evidence or facts that are not allowed to be used.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We set rules here at the legislature all the time about what's fair and not fair for people to hear and see. We heard testimony about whether or not courts could require transcripts. So the legislature decides what's fair. And right now what you're attempting to do is you're attempting to put your finger on the scale to say insurance companies have to pay less. The person who caused the harm, the person who has been found at fault by a jury, has to pay less because maybe you weren't wearing a seatbelt. That's what you're doing here. I have no other questions, Mr. Chair. I'll have some for the other testifiers.
Representative Lunan, respond or do we go on to the next one?
We'll go on to the next testifier, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sir, your name and title and begin.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Hauswaden, President of the Minnesota Trucking Association. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 251, the so-called seatbelt gag rule. We believe that repealing this law will further encourage Minnesotans to take their own safety into account while driving and make our roadways safer. The legislature passed the seatbelt gag rule in 1963, prohibiting evidence of whether a motorist was wearing their seatbelt during an accident from being admitted in a court of law. And there were several justifications at that time. First, seatbelts were not yet mandatory in motor vehicles. There was also no broad consensus that wearing them made people safer. Second, Minnesota did use the principle of contributory negligence in evaluating a plaintiff's claim. At that time, if a jury found a plaintiff even 1% at fault for their accident, they were completely barred from recovering damages. The gag rule offered plaintiffs some procedural protection by removing the question of seatbelt use entirely. Well, almost 50 years later, things have changed. Seatbelts, as you've heard, are mandatory in motor vehicles, and the statistics clearly demonstrate that seatbelts promote safety and save lives. And furthermore, as you've also heard, Minnesota no longer follows the rule of contributory negligence. We replace it with comparative fault, which allows a plaintiff's recovery to be reduced proportionately to their fault rather than barring them from recovery altogether. And finally, we've made failure to wear your seatbelt a primary traffic offense. Why have one law in the books criminalizing non-use of seatbelts and another that removes the mere fact of seatbelt use from being from the legal process altogether? So simply put, the original justifications for passing the seatbelt gag rule no longer apply. Repealing it will encourage Minnesota motorists to wear their seatbelt and take responsibility for their own safety. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Members, questions?
Okay, thank you. You have, I'll let you give your own name and title here on the pronunciation.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and board members. My name is Cedar Abadie. Today I'm here to testify in support of repeal of Minnesota's seatbelt gag rule and on behalf of Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. As you've already heard, the public policy basis underlying the existing seatbelt gag rule has substantially disappeared over time. National usage of seatbelts today is at about 87%, and in Minnesota it's much higher. Our population buckles up at a rate of about 94%. We do that daily. Having fully adopted this very simple and effective personal safety measure that we know can save our lives in the foreseeable event of a motor vehicle accident. The high rates of seatbelt usage in Minnesota are, in fact, a happy consequence, a result that came about in no small measure due to the efforts here at the legislature and by enforcement actions at the state and local and municipal levels. At every opportunity, on the roads and in the classrooms and even in doctor's offices, Minnesotans are reminded about the critical importance of taking a couple seconds to buckle up and prevent or reduce their risk of very serious injury. And in part, the reason we're so consistent about enforcing and reinforcing this message is because motor vehicle accidents are, in fact, so very foreseeable. There's approximately 10 million motor vehicle accidents in a year, nationally, in any given year. In Minnesota, of course, we have our fair share. In 2015, there were about more than 181,000 Minnesotans were involved in a motor vehicle accident in 2015. That's a population of all of Duluth and Plymouth combined. Against that backdrop, then, of consistent and effective safety messaging and a very foreseeable and understandable risk, it's incongruous at best to maintain the current seatbelt gag rule. Keeping the outdated rule in place would have the result, and does have the result, of a Minnesotan on a civil jury. Having likely, based on the statistics, right, buckled up on their way to the courthouse, taking that action to ensure their safety in the foreseeable event of, or foreseeable risk of an accident, they're sitting in that jury box and they're prohibited from hearing at all about whether the injured plaintiff took that same simple action to prevent the or to reduce the injuries that they suffered in that accident. So consider this. You've heard about how there's all these other laws that if a person breaks, we're allowed to consider. Minnesota Department of Public Safety listed the contributing factors for all traffic fatalities in 2015. Okay? The list included drunk driving, speed, distracted driving, of course, and lack of seatbelt use. But only one of those identified and objectively verifiable contributing factors is prohibited from consideration by a jury for an injured plaintiff's condition. Although drunk driving was the number one contributing cause of traffic fatalities in 2015, lack of seatbelt use was a close second, followed only much more distantly by distracted driving or speeding. The fact is, continuing to send this consistent message about the critical importance of individuals exercising that safety measure of buckling up, continuing that consistent message requires that juries be allowed to consider seatbelt use. Practice embraces the tenet that motorists should always wear belts to reduce their potential for serious injury. The gag rule unfairly and illogically shifts the burden from unbelted occupants by allowing them to shift the weight of their decision not to buckle up onto another driver. For these reasons, we encourage the correction of this rule. I'll take questions.
Questions, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess as you were going through those reasons, it was occurring to me that all those other reasons would be causes for the accident itself. And I just want to make sure that you're not testifying, and I don't think anybody is, that lack of seatbelts would cause the accident itself, correct? I mean, the crash, because I guess that's the distinction I make with the other causes that you referenced. Is that right?
That is correct.
And so then I guess that is a distinction regarding that factor then, is because then you talked about there being this injury that's not the fault of the person, but I guess if we envision that, we know the juries are in fact hearing what the factors are that caused the accident in the first place, right, then I guess that's a separate factor, it seems to me. Then, and at that point, then the person who, let's say, caused the accident, the other person, is to a certain extent taking the person where they find them, because it is a that's a separate factor. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do understand what you're saying, Chair and Representative. I understand that distinction, and I recognize that the debate falls into causation of the accident and causation of the injury. And we would argue, of course, that the failure to wear your seatbelt has a role to play in the causation of the injury, and that's the only compensable thing. There's no compensation for an – well, I shouldn't say there's no compensation, but the compensation sought by an injured plaintiff is for their injuries. And the degree to which those injuries are exacerbated or made more severe by the choice not to buckle up, when 94% of Minnesotans do, and therefore a person operating a motor vehicle is entitled to expect that other motorists on the roadway do also share that practice.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, I mean, although reminding ourselves this is somebody who in this scenario is the person who caused the accident, so I mean, I don't have too much sympathy at that point for them, for their concerns about what the other person, they're being resenting or having concerns with the fact the other person not wearing a seatbelt because they're the ones who caused the accident. But I guess I want to build on what Representative Hillstrom was asking about before, because it seems to me that whether somebody has insurance may well end up being a contributing factor in some way, cause someone perhaps to feel that they can drive somewhat more recklessly, this sort of thing, based on them having that coverage. I guess would you support, in the interest of having all the relevant information in front of juries, support having that be something that could be admissible as well?
You don't want to answer that, Mr. Chairman. The rule of evidence, well, as you know, Representative Pinto, the judge would decide what would be a mitigating factor in the cause. In a civil litigation, the lawsuit is not who actually caused the accident. I think that's actually over on the criminal side. What the lawsuit is about is the loss. What was my injury or my loss? And that's where this becomes a contributing factor.
I think, Mr. Chair, I mean, but the first step, I mean, you know, duty breach, causation, damages, right? I mean, the first step is knowing what the cause is and knowing that, in fact, before you get to the loss, you need to know who's responsible for causing the cars to be crashing into one another in the first place. Mm-hmm. Isn't that correct, Representative Luna?
Absolutely.
And so I guess, Mr. Chair, then back to the point, though, about insurance, I understood that a judge is going to have to make the determination under Rule 403, as referenced before, but the fact that, you know, would under Rule 401, would in fact be, the fact that somebody has insurance, would that be something that could tend to cause something to be more probable or less probable, cause me driving a certain way? Seems like that's something that could in fact be the case in a given situation. Somebody may. So it's, I guess what I'm wanting to understand from Representative Lunan is, would you then support, in the interest of having all relevant information, have whether somebody has insurance, have that be something that a court and a jury could consider as well?
Representative Lunan? Mr. Chairman and Representative Pinto, my answer is no. That isn't any different than if someone's involved in a car accident and they're a retired police officer, that factor has no bearing either on how much they're injured or what their loss was. It's just, it has nothing to do with it.
Mr. Chair, if someone knows that they have coverage, that may well be the case that they could then be able to drive more recklessly based on the fact of having that coverage. I mean, it seems like it's got at least more connection than the fact that someone's a retired police officer, for example.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and what happens in that case is the jury would decide that, in fact, someone was operating the vehicle recklessly, so that already would get pulled in. Why they were operating recklessly isn't the issue. It's the fact that if they were doing the mechanics of behaving negligent, which I believe is failing to act as a reasonable person would act, which is what you're talking about, the act itself already brings that in. The factor of why you would do it, I don't think it's admissible in a civil case right now if I got a ticket in an accident. I don't think that's allowed to be in right now, simply because it's the criminal evidence does not become part of the civil case.
Wow.
Mike. Yes, final comment, Mr. Chair. I guess what's frustrating is we're using phrases like gag rule and all relevant evidence and essentially sort of trust the court, trust the jury, allow them to do this, and it seems like well, then we should be doing that with all the information and allow the court and the jury to make that determination. In any given particular situation, it seems like going the one way versus the other. If in fact that's the way we want to go, then it seems like it makes sense to open everything up. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, what we're looking for is any evidence that played a role in the outcome and the amount of injury the jury should be able to consider, period.
All right. Just to add a comment here, it's really a stretch to me to believe that having insurance should have an impact on how a person drives. The other fact that not wearing a seatbelt actually can cause an accident. I've been to a number of accidents where I found out that the person starts into it. Well, at least it makes it worse. The person starts to slide on a sideways down the highway, and you get your butt taken right out of the seat, and you can't hold onto the steering wheel, and you roll over, and it makes it worse. Also, if you're not wearing your seatbelt, you become a flying missile. I've been to accidents where you killed somebody else that was wearing a seatbelt. Mother killed her daughter because she had her seatbelt on, flew in, and headbutted her and killed her. So having a seatbelt, as bad as that scenario sounds, can have quite a difference. And I'm not an attorney, and this is the first time I've ever heard of the seatbelt gag rule. And to me, it just makes common sense. I don't think you're putting your finger on a scale. What you're doing is allowing all the evidence to see which way the scale tips. I don't know why in the world, and the argument that the harness on the tower and you fall, it seems very applicable. And I know there's going to be testimony in opposition to this, but I'd like to hear what they think about that analogy. Representative Ward, and then we've got Representative Grossel, Representative Ward, and Representative Hillstrom. Representative Grossel.
I'll be short. Is it Ms. Cedar?
Yes.
What's your last name?
Abadie is my last name.
Abadie?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I guess I didn't, maybe I missed something there, but what Representative Pinto brought up, let's go back to your information. Was your information stating that the leading cause of death was DUIs and right on down the list?
No, sir. It was the leading, what was the exact language? The contributing factors to
these deaths.
Right.
To these deaths.
To those, the 400 or so, I'm not sure that's the right number, the traffic fatalities that occurred in 2015 and Minnesota.
Okay. It wasn't the leading cause of the accidents or the crashes, rather.
No.
Those were the leading causes of the deaths.
Correct.
Okay. Because there's no such, for us and for law enforcement, there's no such thing as accidents. These are things that can be avoided. These deaths can be avoided.
Mm-hmm.
Serious injuries can be avoided by putting on our seatbelts. So, I mean, I would have to agree with the chair as far as this information being common sense, that a jury should be able to see some of these things. So I just wanted to make sure that the leading cause of these deaths were the distracted driving, the DUI, the not wearing a seatbelt, right on down the line.
Yes, sir, Mr. Representative.
Okay, Representative Ward, Hillstrom, and Dean. Representative Ward. Oh, okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lunan, don't we exclude their prior convictions from the trial as well? So if the person who's found liable actually had some prior bad driving conduct, prior DWI convictions, prior all sorts of things, don't we have rules where we say the jury doesn't get to hear that either?
Representative Lunan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I don't really know. I know that from an insurance standpoint, which is where I come from, everything is the moment of the loss. And what was everyone's behavior? Where were they at in the car? What was their amount of negligence? And that is the evidence that the jury gets to hear.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think, Representative Lunan, this isn't the first time I've heard this bill, even this year. We've heard it in other committees as well. When there's discussion about the jury getting to hear everything, again, prior bad acts, prior convictions, prior felony convictions, prior DWI convictions, those are all things that the legislature and the rules exclude from the jury because we think that it will bias the jury against one side or the other.
the goal of this bill is to bias the jury against the person who is not wearing their seatbelt when, in fact, they were found not to be at fault for the crash. So that's what's happening here. We are saying the person who caused the crash, who was found liable for the wrongful act, should have to pay less because the person who was harmed wasn't wearing a seatbelt. That's what you're advocating here.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Luna.
I disagree with that assertion. Wearing the seatbelt is a contributing and timely factor in the level of injury and whether an injury occurred. Prior convictions, what your past driving habits are, may, but in most cases I assume may not be a factor at all, and I agree that that could prejudice the jury. But the seatbelt information, it has to be proved that it was a factor. It isn't just a gimme. There isn't an algorithm that goes in there. It would still have to be proved to the jury that that was a factor in the injury.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this might be to the testifier, the author. So we're spending a lot of time talking about seatbelts because this bill is about seatbelts and seatbelt uses. And since 1991, cars have been required to have airbags. And we've talked a lot about seatbelts reducing injuries and things like that. Do you have any statistics or evidence about how much airbags have actually caused injuries and accidents? And we want to go a little bit farther and ask the question, when I purchased my car in 2006, I had the option of buying a side airbag package, and I chose not to buy it. So is that something that should be admissible in the court, too, that, you know, if I'd had side airbags in my car, my injuries could have been reduced by that, and so I would not be able to recover, you know, personal damages for injuries. So just those two questions, if you could speak to those.
Well, short answer, Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, happy to do that. The airbag thing, I don't have that data with me. I've seen the data, I just don't have it with. And as far as the side airbag, again, in a car accident, everything is the snapshot of the moment of the loss. So if you took a key and turned off an airbag, that would be a factor. If you never purchased the airbag, it probably would not.
Okay. We've got another testifier, Joel Carlson, Minnesota Association for Justice.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning, Mr. Carlson. Your name and title, and begin.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Joel Carlson. I'm a lobbyist here at the Capitol for the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I have to tell you that I'm not buying the pie that Representative Lunan is selling. This is likely the most unfair bill that you will deal with this session, the most unfair. And while we can all agree that seatbelts are an important safety tool, and 94% of us wear them, and women are a little better, about 98% of women wear them, this legislation punishes good drivers, children, passengers, and those who actually exercise their freedom not to wear a seatbelt at the expense of bad drivers, distracted drivers, and their insurance companies. It is really a drunk and distracted driver protection act. You know, using the seatbelt evidence to blame someone who has done nothing wrong to cause an injury is the height of injustice, we feel. And we talked a little bit about crash facts. And there are 75,000 reported automobile accidents in Minnesota. And we mentioned the number of people involved. There are 30,000 Minnesotans that are injured in automobile accidents, 3,634 of them, when the last time they issued their report, were alcohol-related. And that resulted in over 2,200 injuries and 137 deaths. When we talk about contributing factors, and let's be clear about this, and the crash facts notes it, none of the contributing factors listed had anything to do with the seatbelt. And what they want to do with this evidence is they want to use this as contributory fault so that they can bar you from making a recovery when you have been run over by a drunk or distracted driver. So imagine a situation where a family, a teenager, a child, elderly person is rear-ended by the drunk driver. In every single case now, the use or non-use will become an evidence. Every single case where there's an injury. We think about this is only going to be used in trial. That's not the issue. It's an issue, but it's not the biggest issue. In every single one of these cases, they're going to allege that you used or not used their seatbelt, and we're going to reduce your damages and settlement because of that. And how are you going to prove it? What do you do when you're in an accident, when you're in a fender bender? You get out. How are you going to establish that you were wearing your seatbelt? Are you going to hire an expert to have them prove that you were wearing it? That's what's going to happen here with this legislation. And if you don't think it will happen, I sent around a sheet of paper. Look at this vehicle. This vehicle was run into by an 80,000-pound 18-wheeler from a driver who was a half hour shy of his driving time for a day, fell asleep, and ran into this motor coach. This resulted in 4 serious injuries requiring months of hospitalization and 1 death. This happened to be in a state where they allow this very evidence in trial. And what did they do? They blame the victims in this crash for their own injuries. Tracy Morgan, this is 2015. They blame him for his injuries because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt in this motor coach, and we've probably all been in them. And I guarantee you, you're not putting on your belt. I can almost guarantee you, you're not putting on your belt when that happens. That's what they do. And if they're going to do it to a national celebrity where one comedian in this crash died, Jimmy Mack, if they're going to try and reduce their damages with people that have means to fight back, what do you think they're going to do to your constituents? You know, this daycare providers that have kids that get out of the seat that I run into, now it's their fault. The number of instances in Minnesota where this happens, Gene Johnson in St. Cloud, hit by a distracted driver, who was killed, the driver was killed, 60 miles an hour through a stop sign. She's still recovering from her injuries. It's her fault. And if they're able to use that evidence to reduce the amount of damages that you pay, we all pay for it. Through medical assistance, through other public programs, we're shifting the cost of automobile accidents to other people. You know, this law's been in place for 54 years. For 36 of those years, these same insurance companies for auto manufacturers used it as a shield to protect themselves from liability when the seatbelt caused the injury. And the courts reversed that. Actually, the legislature reversed that in 1999. Now they're here to use it as a sword to reduce the amount of damages that their insureds cause, not through the fault of my driving, but through the result of the negligent driver. And I just think that that is the height of unfairness. And I'll leave you with one last case, Mr. Chairman and members. They allow this evidence the way they want to use it here. They allow it in Florida. And there was a case about a year ago. The guy's name was Rylan Nye. He was parked. He was rear-ended and ejected from his car, and he died. The person who was driving the car, an off-duty police officer, fled the scene. Left. They found him. They argued at the trial that Mr. Nye was responsible for his own injuries because he was not wearing a seatbelt at the time of that impact, and therefore he should not recover any damages. The defendant at that time was in jail for vehicular homicide. He couldn't even be at the trial. And the jury in that case found 70% of the fault on the driver who was parked and not wearing a seatbelt, 30% on the negligent driver. In Minnesota, that means zero recovery, and that's what it meant for that family, too. That's an injustice, Mr. Chairman, that I really don't think we should allow in Minnesota, and we haven't in the past. I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Mr. Carlson, so in a trial like that, a civil trial, is the person allowed to argue why they don't think that the lack of their seatbelt, I mean, if we pass this law, wouldn't they still have the right to make that argument that just because I wasn't wearing my seatbelt shouldn't have that much to do with it, and then go on with all sorts of evidence that he or she claimed?
Mr. Chairman and members, that's not exactly how it works, but it's a great question. And they will argue that there are a couple things, and this is important for this committee because this will add cost to trials. It will add to the number of trials. So when you look at this in a budgetary standpoint, I want you to be thinking about this. This is now medical testimony, and the Minnesota courts require medical testimony to be established by medical experts. So each side now is going to have a battle of competing experts. And it is not just I want to make sure we're clear on this, too. It is not just the use of the seatbelt or the non-use. It's the use of the seatbelt, too. So do I get to argue now that you were injured more because your head hit that airbag? And I'm not responsible for that. You can go to the auto manufacturer. Because it's use or non-use that we're repealing. If you turn over the bill, you'll see, and I disagree with Representative Lunan a little bit, well, maybe a lot, we are also repealing the protection against child restraints in this bill. And he said that's not included. It is included. And so first, you have to have experts that say you were injured more because of the non-use, or you were injured because of the use of the seatbelt. Many people's injuries are enhanced by the use of the seatbelt, even though they are very important safety devices, and we encourage their use. But how are they going to handle that? Over 30 states just completely bar this evidence from being used. We're certainly not an island here. And the three that allow it to liability, the way they are wanting to use it here, there are some horrible results that you would not want to have happen for your constituents.
We've got to move along, don't we? But back to my question, you said that isn't how it works. That actually is how it works. I mean, you contradicted me, but then you went on to agree with me that both sides would be able to present their case. Experts are not spend millions of dollars and hire great law firms, but each would get a chance to argue it. What this law does, that's why I'm questioning, it just allows that to be used. And then the State Patrol and others all over, all these advocacy groups all over the state have an organization now named TZD, Towards Zero Deaths, and their main thing in there is the wearing of seatbelts and the implications that you have for further injury if you don't wear them. So,
Mr. Chairman, I didn't mean to comment. I thought you meant the parties get to argue about it. Well, my point is that this testimony has to be established not by who was in the accident or the other driver. It has to be established by expert testimony, which adds to the cost, length, and complexity of the trials. And we're absolutely in favor of the Towards Zero Death movement. We were very supportive of the bill to end distracted driving. But this allows those who don't follow those rules to receive a windfall from the damages that they've caused because they can escape full accountability for their wrongful conduct when they injure someone else. That's what we feel is so unfair.
Mr. Lunan, how does an insurance company make up for huge payments out in a case? And doesn't that, it's a kind of a pointed question naturally, but
fair enough.
What I'm worried about is insurance company pays out money that doesn't have to. I mean, they're a business. They don't want to pay more money than they have to. They're making it sound like bad guys for trying to get out from under debt. So naturally they would argue their case. And so I worry about those large expenses and payouts being passed on to the customers also because somebody didn't take the natural precautions that they should have.
Mr. Chairman, a solution to one of the testifiers' problems with the high cost of litigation is let's go back to a contributory negligence state where either you collect or you don't. Problem solved. You eliminate two-thirds of the lawsuits. As far as his contention that this, he disagrees with me with the applying to child seats. I took the liberty of printing out the current statute. I went ahead and highlighted it for him in case he didn't have a chance to prepare. The current gag order does not apply to youth seats. So when we remove the gag order, nothing changes there because there isn't a gag order there now under subsection 4, paragraph A. The insurance companies, those settlements are based on what a jury awards as to who caused the accident and what were the factors in the actual loss, whether it's bodily injury or property damage.
We've got Representative Dean Ward, Considine, and Becker Finn. We're looking at possibly having to put off a bill, but I'd like to finish this one at least. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm trying to think of this from my own personal practical situation. So I'm in an accident. I've been in a few accidents, or crash. My first sort of instinct is to unbuckle my seatbelt. I mean, and figure out what's happening. So I have no documentation that I was actually wearing my seatbelt. And if the accusation is made by the insurance company that, you know, the additional injury I may have had, whether it was bumping my head or something like that, was caused because I didn't have my seatbelt on, how do I prove I had my seatbelt on?
Mr. Chairman? Guilty until or innocent until proven guilty. In this case, the burden is on the insurance company to prove you didn't, which would be the evidence in the police report. If there was no evidence or no documentation that you weren't wearing the seatbelt, I can't imagine a jury or a judge accepting that. So it's just the opposite. The burden isn't on the person to prove they had the seatbelt on. The burden would be on the plaintiff's attorney to prove that you didn't wear the seatbelt.
Mr. Chair, so if the insurance company is going out to prove that I wasn't wearing my seatbelt, how do I defend myself?
Representative,
to say that I was, because I have no evidence that I was. So if the accusation is made that I wasn't, and you know, I don't know what they would be using to prove that I wasn't, but I virtually have no defense against that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Dean. I'm not a lawyer, but I would assume that in the rule of evidence segment, they would decide if there was enough data there to go forward with this. Again, the burden would not be on the defendant in this case to prove he had the seatbelt on. The burden would have to be on the in this case, the insurance company, to prove that you did not. My opinion on it, I'll say it very quickly, would be they would go by what was on the police report, which would be based on what you said.
One final question. So if the case before me is I have to prove that, you know, I have to defend that I had my seatbelt on, and they, you know, have an expert, medical expert that comes in and says these injuries would not have been sustained had the individual been wearing a seatbelt and I had my seatbelt on, do I have to go out and hire another expert to come in and to try to create the evidence that I actually was wearing my seatbelt? Or, you know, I mean, generally when you're in an accident, you don't think, you know, should I get out my video camera and record that I have my seatbelt on? I was just in an accident, so that when, you know, it comes to a situation in court, they actually have some immediate evidence, and you know, you can always make the argument, well, they put the seatbelt on after the accident and then they record it. But is this really about expanding business for expert witnesses in cases involving seatbelts?
Quick answer.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, no, it's not. And again, the burden would be to prove that you were not wearing your seatbelt. An expert witness stating that your injury is consistent with not wearing a seatbelt may or not be admissible. But again, that's the judge's determination in the rule of evidence segment, and the jury makes the decision on whether the data is valid.
Okay, Representative Ward.
Defer to Mr. Carson.
Mr. Chairman and members, and kind of gets to court funding, but in 2016, there were 2,679 personal injury cases filed in Minnesota. That's it. And 125 of those went to trial. We're talking about 75,000 automobile accidents and 30,000 people that are injured. I'm worried about how many of these would now go to trial that currently settle. But what's going to happen to the settlements that you and your family are entitled to? I understand the premium issue, although this won't have any impact on premium. But those losses that the responsible party doesn't pay are borne by you and your family and your constituents. And that's the biggest problem. The 200 or the 2,600 cases that are filed in court, that's not the issue. It's all the other cases. And when they allege, Representative Dean, that you weren't wearing it, and your lawyer says, you know what, we're going to have to hire an expert for $15,000 to fight back against that. And they've got the resources to do it, you don't. That's where it's going to have an impact on every single case. That's the biggest problem with this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is actually for the gentleman representing the truckers. And as he's coming down, I just relate a personal story. I was driving through Truman, Minnesota, and I had a headlight out. The officer stopped me, told me that, and after we had talked for a minute or two, asked me. He said, did you have your seatbelt on when I came up? He had no clue. So I actually answered truthfully and got a ticket. No, I didn't have it on. But going back to the police report, I'm not sure that that's going to be necessarily accurate when you have the police officer asking you if you had it on or not. They're not really paying that much attention to it. I was sitting here trying to figure out why you testified. This is strictly about lowering payouts for your members that have killed and maimed people?
Sir.
Mr. Chairman, the trucking companies hold safety as a core value. We think anything that can encourage safe driving behavior is a good thing. Seatbelt use is a good thing. It not only protects passengers in their own cars, but it protects truck drivers, because when cars and trucks collide, in two-thirds to three-quarters of the cases, it's a behavior of the car driver that caused the crash. So this is about making sure that people are taking responsibility for their behavior, and that's why we support the bill.
Okay.
Thank you. So you'll be testifying at numerous safety bills all along. We'll be seeing quite a bit of you.
Mr. Chairman, as bills come up that align with what we think are appropriate for safety enhancement, we do support them.
Okay, Representative Becker-Finn and then Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first, just wanted to clear up, because I'm looking at what we would be repealing here, and it specifically includes child passenger restraint systems. That isn't left out. It isn't just applying to the use of seatbelts. It's this whole subdivision in Statute 169.685. So just wanted to clear that up. It's right there. So one question I had is, you know, we've heard a couple testifiers talk about, you know, their desire to see people be safer. Do we have any proof that changing this would actually result in more people wearing seatbelts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no.
Okay, thank you. And then also just wanted to state, and others have stated this as well, you know, Representative Dean talked about, you know, I'm a mom. I drive around in my minivan with my two kids in the back seat, and, you know, we've had a couple of close calls, and small children are also the first ones to unbuckle their seatbelts and try to figure out what's going on in those moments. And so, I mean, it even gets more complicated than just trying to prove one person. You're now up against, you know, you're now a mom with injured kids who was potentially hit by a distracted or drunk driver, and now you're trying to prove that you're a good mom and had your kids in your seatbelt. In their seatbelts, and it turns into this whole other thing that isn't about remedying the wrong of who actually caused the accident. And I think The same way we seem to be having trouble here in this committee differentiating between the cause of the accident, so but for that drunk driver there is not a crash, and factors that may have contributed to the level or type of injury, the same way we're struggling with that here in this committee, a jury is going to be probably even more confused, and that's why this is important and why this would protect families who are really the victims of these types of accidents. So just wanted to clarify that's really what we're talking about here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's the nature of comparative negligence. You could go to contributory negligence and all that would go away, but I don't think that's the move to make.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, you need to read what comparative negligence is, which isn't in this bill. You need to read what that is. It has to do with actions involving fault. And you can maybe say that this issue relates to mitigating a damage. That's not how they want to use it. They want to use it as comparative fault, and that's not what comparative fault is. That's our point. And, Mr. Chairman, you asked the question, or Representative Hillstrom did, about relevance of insurance. I can point to you any number of situations where the coverage that is available is relevant, whether they're arguing that this person's going to have to pay it out of their own pocket, which we know isn't true. That's not presenting honest evidence to the jury. But where it's really a problem is when you have to have family members in your situation, Representative Finn, when they make family members sue each other, because you can't, you have to have the child sue the parent because you can't get the insurance company involved. And then you've got the jury going, what's going on here? This is really wrong, and the family can't get along. Well, it's got nothing to do with that. And I would take the position that's absolutely relevant in those situations because you're fighting, the insurance companies are fighting among themselves. The family members are not fighting. And so it's absolutely relevant in many, many situations. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think we were talking about that in the causation of an accident in the insurance. And I think that from my experience, the people I know that drive without insurance are very careful because they don't want to get picked up even for a stoplight violation, because then a cop is going to ask them for proof of insurance. They don't have any. So they usually drive like this straight to work and straight back, and don't touch me. I don't want to be stopped. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Unless, Mr. Chair, they're one of those defendants that we see who drive without insurance all the time, especially after we take their license for multiple DWIs and all sorts of other things. So, mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, that generalization isn't necessarily quite accurate. However, that's not why I asked to speak. I just want to talk about the fiscal note. Members, right now in your packet you have a fiscal note. I talked with staff because I noticed that the courts were missing from the fiscal note, wanted to make certain that they were included. It's my understanding that that has been requested, and we just don't have that information yet, Mr. Chair. So I expect that we will see an updated fiscal note by the end of the week, according to fiscal staff.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just following up on your comment, Mr. Chair, if it in fact is true that drivers without insurance drive more safely and more cautiously than drivers with insurance, that would be a great reason for insurance to be admissible because it's relevant as to the likelihood of causing accidents. So actually that comment, to my mind, would certainly be a reason to add admissibility of insurance because it does mean someone's going to be able to drive more risky than those drivers we've observed who don't have insurance and are driving very cautiously. Thank you.
And you can have an amendment when it comes up. Representative, anybody? I thought somebody rose their hand over here. Okay, anybody from the public?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members.
Representative Lunan, any closing comments?
Well, just want to thank you for your time, and I would appreciate a support vote.
I'm going to leave it up to the committee. We can either, the other bill might be kind of controversial if you want to do it now in 10 minutes, or we can come back at recess till 7 and come back and get it, and unless you think it's too much to take on. Or
it's Mr. Chair, I think it's also controversial. It's kind of like Representative Lunan's bill.
You didn't answer, though, yet. What would you rather do?
Are you laying it over, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Well, Mr. Chair, if we want to, let's just do it. We can make certain that we have our issues if you bring it back as part of the omnibus bill.
Yeah, true. You can have amendments for more discussion then. Right. So, all right, Representative Zerwas. Will that, okay, if we go to about 12:10 then? Or?
Sure. And so, Mr. Chair, you're just like,
yeah.
Mr. Lewis? We don't
have to trick on you. Okay, Representative Zerwas, you want to move your bill to be laid over for possible inclusion?
That's my motion, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'll be brief.
House File 1281. All right.
Yep. To be laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Zerwas. Sorry, the DE1 amendment.
There's a DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair, if we can adopt that to get the bill in the shape in which I'd like to discuss it.
Okay, Representative Zerwas moved the amendment DE1 to get in the shape he'd like. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? To your amended bill, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I'll be brief. In 2009, the interest rate regarding prejudgment interest was dramatically increased to 10%. In 2010, cities, counties, and townships came to the legislature to ask for relief, explaining that a 10% interest rate was not connected to the market, was not connected to reality, and was a burden on them. It was too hard to pay. The legislature for cities, counties, and townships and for government agreed that a 10% interest rate was too high and lowered the interest rate back down to a floor of 4%. What we're here today to do is asking the legislature to recognize that a 10% interest rate that is too costly for government is also too costly for the private market. And the same reasons that the legislature lowered the interest rate to a bottom level of 4% for government are the same reasons we should do that for private parties. A couple quick points. The DE1 amendment has this apply to just pre-judgment interest, meaning the time from when a lawsuit is first begun until a judge or a jury has awarded a verdict. That is the part that we're proposing to bring down to a floor of 4%. We would keep the current statute that post-verdict, meaning that if you get an award, but the person that you've gotten the award from delays in delivering that award and paying, that 10% rate that's in current law will stay. So this in no way entices or encourages someone to postpone a trial or a postpone payment after a verdict has come in place. I don't know if this was included in your packet, members, but it's a pre-interest judgment by state. 34 states are now below 10%, and I think in the last 3 years, 25 states have lowered their interest rates. State by state, people have realized with historically low interest rates in our current state statute, it's supposed to be connected to the rate of the Treasury bill, the one-year Treasury bill, and then a floor of 4% is what we did for government. A 10% rate has no connection at all to the Treasury, the one-year Treasury bill. 25 states in just the last 3 years have recognized that, and all 25 of those states have lowered their interest rates. And so that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to get Minnesota to come in conformity with 34 other states, 25 just in the last 3 years. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have one testifier.
Sir, if you give your name and title again and begin.
Thank you, Chair, committee members. Troy Poets with the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association. I agree with what the representative said. It's my understanding that the intent of the statute was to have a rational relation between the interest that's charged pre-judgment and what that injured party could have gotten with their money had they invested it. It wasn't meant to be 5-10 times what they could have gotten in an investment vehicle. It's supposed to compensate the victim. It's not supposed to put them in a better position than they were. So we are in support of the amendment. And just to head one argument off at the pass, because I'm assuming it might come up, when you say insurance defense lawyer, that's what a lot of people that do what I do call themselves, but it's kind of a misnomer. We represent individuals. We're hired by the insurance companies, but we represent the individuals, and that's where our duty lies. We represent them. And let's say they have a $100,000 policy, and they're in an accident where someone dies, so their exposure is way above that. So it's not just the insurance company's money on the line. It's our clients, you know, farms, things like that on the line. So this isn't just about an insurance company being able to afford it. It's about the average citizen being able to afford a 10% prejudgment interest rate. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Zilfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So who gets to decide if they want to settle? So if the person, your client, you just testified, decides that they think there was a reason to settle, does the insurance company get to stop them from settling?
Representative Hillman, Chair, that's an interesting question because it's something that I face every day. And the insured does have a lot of input in that, especially if they're a business owner and it could affect their reputation. For example, I represent bars and dram shop cases where someone has too much to drink, possibly, and my bars would never overserve anyone. But let's say that happened. They don't want to settle because they don't want that bad press out there. So they actually do have a lot of say, and insurers, for the most part, will listen to their insureds as long as the insureds know the risk that if there's an excess verdict, guess who's on the hook.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in the other. If the insured decides they want to settle, but the insurance company doesn't want them to settle, does the insurance company have the ability to say, no, we're not paying that?
Okay, just so I understand it, Chair, Representative. In other words, the insurance company is saying, I realize you want to settle, but we really want to roll the dice with the jury and go try this.
Mr. Chair, yes, they say, we don't want to pay that much. We understand you want to settle for whatever it is that the maximum amount of your insurance is, but we don't want to do that. We don't think that's the liability. We don't think that's the right thing to do. Can the insurance company say, no, we're not settling?
Mr. Chair, Madam Representative, they can. I can tell you the reality is on the ground, they don't. Because they're subjecting themselves to an assignment of what's called a bad faith case by their own insured. Let's say the person gets lit up for $1 million and they're sitting on a $50,000 policy. That person has a bad faith case against their own insurer. It's kind of complex, but I mean, they can assign that then to the plaintiff. So an insurance company does so at their peril, and we know there's bad faith laws in Minnesota. I would suggest that they do that at their peril. I hope that answers your question.
Joel Carl, come on down. Name and title again. Yeah. And we got about 4 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. I'll speak to the DE1 amendment briefly. And you need to know that pre- and post-judgment interest rates have three important public policy goals. Compensate you for the loss of use of your money, prevent frivolous appeals, which the amendment tried to address, and that's the compensate you for the loss of use of your money is the one I want to focus on in the DE1 amendment. You need to know that people that have doctor bills, credit card bills, they get paid whatever their interest is. If you look on the bill on lines 1.19, where it talks about money losses where there is a contract. So if your hospital has a 12% interest rate on your bill, they're going to get to collect that. Where this prejudgment interest comes into play is for your general damages, your pain, suffering, wage loss, things that you've suffered, which principally are important damages for women and children who don't have high economic losses in many cases. So what we're saying is that we're going to treat you differently than everybody else in this litigation, and we're going to give you 4%. But everybody else who has a contract that they've been able to get, whether it's 18% on your credit card or whatever it is, they're going to get whatever they're entitled to, but you're entitled to less. And this is not a savings rate. We need to try to get you to focus on that. This is to replace the money you've had to spend while this case is going on to borrow to keep your family going. You're not borrowing that at 4%, and you're certainly not borrowing at the Treasury rate. That's why this was changed, because it was unfair. This law promotes settlement, and we shouldn't differentiate between the types of damages. If I have a contract, great, it's paid. If I don't, I should get a reasonable rate and not a savings rate. And last thing, Mr. Chairman, if you look at the sheet, there's 30 states on here that are already above 4%. So we don't need to race to the bottom here. We can treat our constituents at least fairly, and this one just isn't it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas, why don't you give a closing comment, and then we'll remember Representative Hillstrom wants to bring this up again when the bill comes up again and finish this conversation, so that we're cut short today. So.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for letting us do this part today, and we'll wrap up during markup. Members, this with the DE-1 amendment, this is the exact same language that was adopted by this committee in 2015 and passed off the House floor as a part of the public safety omnibus bill at that time. I encourage your support, and I thank the chair for the time for the hearing.
Hey, member, thank you for your patience, and the meeting is... No, we're coming back. We're meeting adjourned.